The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Washington College of Law at American University in Washington, D.C., where we're proud to be celebrating International Right to Know Day today. This is the fourth time that the Collaboration on Government Secrecy, our Transparency Center here at the law school, has celebrated this event. And I'm proud to be able to say that this is now the principal place for doing so within the United States, although the celebration is truly something that occurs worldwide on September 28th every year. And I'm also pleased to be able to report to you that now this is the 12th such program, International Right to Know Day, Freedom of Information Day, other academic conferences, and our annual assessment of Obama administration transparency. This is the 12th program that we've had now with CGS in the last 3 years. We started with our first International Right to Know Day program 3 years ago today, in the fall of 2007 when CGS was created, and with the support of the law school and some foundation support, it has worked out very well that we've been able to have these programs, and we're going to be continuing certainly in the next year. For those of you who are interested in domestic transparency matters, we will be having our annual assessment of the Obama administration's transparency efforts on January 20th, 2011, and then we're aiming also for January 20th, 2012, and also our celebration of Freedom of Information Day, the domestic counterpart to International Right to Know Day, which everyone knows, of course, is on James Madison's birthday each year, March 16th, which is the centerpiece time of what is now called Sunshine Week. And this morning, before we start, I want to give you just a quick idea of what we're going to try to do today, which is something a little bit different. We have had audio link-ups in the past, but today we're going to have a video link-up. We're going to be connected to Scotland, and we're going to be connected to a professor from Dundee Law School at Dundee University, who is a visiting scholar here at Princeton, and we're going to be talking about freedom of information, international transparency, with the second Freedom of Information Center in the world. When CGS began operations 3 years ago, it turned out that we were the first such center for the academic study of that subject area at any law school in the world. And then the second such center came online in January last year at Dundee Law School. And as you'll hear later today, it's a joint enterprise between Dundee Law School and the Scottish Information Commissioner. We'll have representatives of each of those two offices here today. We're also this afternoon going to have Tom Sussman back for what has become our annual survey of freedom of information developments, legislative developments, implementation developments worldwide. And we'll have a report on how many nations of the world now have joined the International Right to Know community and what the change has been since last year. And Tom Sussman and Toby McIntosh and one of the CGS Dean's Fellows will be speaking about that. And earlier in the afternoon, I'm pleased to say that we're going to be able to provide focus on a major international transparency development in just the past few months. And by that, I refer to the fact that on July 1 of this year, the World Bank established a brand new, far-reaching transparency regime for World Bank records. And this is something that applies to 10,000 staff members all worldwide through the World Bank, and it's something that can provide the basis, I think, for the World Bank exercising leadership throughout the world. And speaking of leadership, I also want to bring to your attention that the subject of the United States leadership in international transparency is now a very current one. This is something, by the way, that we covered in a panel that we had here at International Right to Know Day a couple of years ago, the prospect of the United States restoring its role as a leader in transparency worldwide. And I'm happy to be able to note that just last Thursday, I believe it was, the 23rd of September, In his remarks to the General Assembly of the United Nations, President Obama, among other things, said the following, quote, "In all parts of the world, we see the promise of innovation to make government more open and accountable. And now we must build on that progress. And when we gather back here next year, we should bring specific commitments to promote transparency, to fight corruption, to energize civil engagement, to leverage new technologies, so that we strengthen the foundations of freedom in our own countries while living up to the ideals that can light the world." This is the most concrete indication of the United States beginning to restore its role in the world under the current administration after 8 years of, let's just say, losing some ability, to say the least, to lead the world in transparency matters. And it's a very positive development indeed. So you'll hear about the World Bank today also starting its leadership role. We'll have the General Counsel of the World Bank here to speak to that. And now you can think of the United States as moving in that direction officially as well. Now, I'll mention that on this day, International Right to Know Day, around the world, there are a variety of different events and things that commemorate the day. There is an award ceremony in Bulgaria. There is a breakfast roundtable in Kenya. In Macedonia, there's going to be an information stand at Skobie Square. A whole range of things. In the Russian Federation, there will be not just one, but two events in St. Petersburg commemorating this day. Now, that's a brave new world, I think. In Accra, Ghana, where our keynote speaker held a conference not so long ago, there will be information vans going through key neighborhoods, all fostering, promoting transparency. And it doesn't matter the size of the event so much. One of them is merely the planting of a remembrance tree in Uganda and a poetry competition, all range of things. We're happy, very happy that we're able to contribute and be part of the international community in this way. Now, what I'd like to do, because we're running a little bit behind on time, is introduce our keynote speaker, and I think I can summarize it by saying that you could try to find someone with greater experience in international transparency, and even if you look very hard, I'm not sure that you'd be able to do so. Laura Newman is Access to Information Manager. She actually holds two hats at the Carter Center in Atlanta. Her bio information is in the handout, so I'm not going to take a lot of her time by going through that. But she is someone who has conducted conferences in Ghana, in Lima, Peru, in Atlanta, just in the past 3 years since CGS has been in operation. She has done that. She was a speaker at our first Freedom of Information Day conference in March of 2008, and I probably should be formal in introducing her by her full title. But let me just mention that in your handouts we do have the homepage to the Access to Information project, that area of the Carter Center in Atlanta. But I probably should introduce her by her formal name because there's an article that is now a last-minute handout today. It's an article from the Liberian Observer, and it reports on a conference that was held very recently in which Ms. Newman participated and spoke about the U.S. role in international transparency, and the World Bank also was involved as well. And she was referred to in this article as Madam Newman. So I will give to you for our keynote presentation Madam Newman, who is foremost in the area of international transparency. Please help me in welcoming her.
Thank you very much, and thank you for that wonderful introduction. I have to say you've just shortened my speech a tad bit since you took my conclusion away from me, so I have a little more time for questions and answers.
Here's where I have to confess. Ms. Newman and I were not able to coordinate at the last minute. She arrived in Washington at about 2 in the morning from Atlanta. I arrived in Washington about 2 o'clock this morning from Lubbock, Texas, where I was deposing the former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. So I apologize to her that we weren't able to coordinate things at the very last minute as we ordinarily would.
Thank you. And thank you to American University Law School's collaboration on government secrecy and certainly to his executive director, Dan Metcalf, for inviting me to speak this morning. As he mentioned, today marks the 8th annual International Right to Know Day and the 4th annual celebration at American University. International Right to Know Day began as a civil society initiative out of a conference in Bulgaria in 2002 and has grown to include celebrations in over 40 countries of both government and civil society advocates. International Right to Know Day affords us an opportunity to commemorate all of the accomplishments over the past year and to rededicate ourselves to the advancement of the right of access to information. As this is a day of celebration, let me first begin by highlighting some of the successes since we last gathered together in 2009. There are now almost 90 countries with access to information laws, and well over half of our world population is covered by some statutory or regulatory right to information. Powerhouse countries such as Indonesia and Russia saw their laws go into effect. China worked on its implementation of their new open government information regulation, and a number of countries like Liberia and Luxembourg are on the verge of having a Freedom of Information Bill signed into law. Civil society organizations are active in both using the laws that exist and in lobbying for the passage of laws in countries without the right to information. Perhaps the most important event of this past year, as Dan talked about, was the promulgation and adoption of the World Bank's new disclosure policy, which now calls for many more documents to be proactively published as well as made available upon request. But as with any celebration, this is not only a moment to reflect, but also a time to look ahead to the coming years. And with your permission, I would like to focus the remainder of my talk on the agenda for the future, highlighting 5 areas that I believe merit additional consideration. For many of us, we have spent the last decade or so promoting access to information as a fundamental human right and a critical tool in the fight against corruption and for assuring good governance. When we began, the community of practice was in its infancy. We looked to the few big brothers that we had in the United States, people like Dan Metcalf, Canada, Sweden, Australia, and New Zealand. But for the most part, we were all just beginning. We developed from infants to toddlers, continuing in our naivete and believing that governments and multilateral organizations were as committed to the right to information as their rhetoric suggested. Today, we are entering into our teen years. We are no longer as innocent or puppy dog eager. Like teens, we've developed, matured, and become a bit more cynical and certainly more belligerent. We are at times more demanding, more questioning, and more confrontational. As teenagers sometimes do, we focus more on the negatives, like the backsliding in lead countries such as South Africa and Mexico, the concern that the right to information remains a right of the elite rather than for all, and the continuing failures to implement and enforce laws. But in many ways, we are still kids with the same dreams and hopes for a world transformed by the right of access to information. However, without greater attention to some key areas, it's my contention that we will not meet our collective goal of a more transparent world. Late last year, the Carter Center held a small conference for some of the leading international NGOs and donors working on transparency. We called on our colleagues to work together more collaboratively and to collectively develop an agenda that would achieve transparency by 2020. At the culmination of the meeting, we'd agreed on the value of greater collaboration, but had not enunciated a Transparency 2020 agenda. I would like to begin doing so today with all of you. In addition to the continuing work on assuring full implementation and effective enforcement of existing access to information laws, and the amazing efforts to promote greater transparency in sectors such as the environment, extractive industries, and budgets, I propose the 5 following interconnected areas for inclusion in our agenda for the next decade. Agenda item 1, explicit inclusion of transparency and access to information as a necessary ingredient to achieve the Millennium Development Goals. In 2000, at the United Nations Summit, the world agreed on 8 ambitious goals targeted at reducing poverty and improving lives by the year 2015. The 8 Millennium Development Goals are to eradicate extreme poverty and hunger with the target to halve poverty by 2015, to achieve universal primary education, to promote gender equality and empower women, to reduce child mortality rates by 2/3, and improve maternal health by reducing mortality rate by 75%, to combat HIV/AIDS, malaria, and other diseases, to ensure environmental sustainability, and to develop a global partnership for development. With 5 years to go, the UN held the MDG summit last week. As with the goals themselves, there was almost no mention of the imperatives of transparency and access to information to meet these targets. The creation of the Millennium Goals followed years of increasing attention to human development rather than purely economic development. In 1996, the OECD had issued the International Development Goals, which served as a precursor to the MDGs. Like the MDGs, the focus of these goals were hard targets that could more easily be measured, with little explicit attention to soft targets such as transparency, participation, or human rights. While the Millennium Declaration, the rhetoric, recognized the necessity for improved governance to achieve the goals, transparency and access to information remained sidelined. In 2005, Jeffrey Sachs was tasked with convening and leading 10 working groups of technical experts to make recommendations for meeting the MDGs. The final report, Investing in Development, a Practical Plan to Achieve the Millennium Development Goals, was issued before the 2005 summit. One of the chapters in this report focuses on transparency and advocates for greater inclusion of governance and transparency indicators. But as before, neither transparency nor the right to information were highlighted in the ultimate summit declaration or country strategies and work plans. In fact, and perhaps ironically, to a great extent, transparency and access to information were forgotten by all but the United States, which has referenced accountability and transparency most recently. As of 2010, there have been some notable advancements on the goals. But with only 5 years left to achieve the MDGs, the progress has been too uneven and too slow, and at current trends, most developing countries will not meet many of the MDG targets. In the literally thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of pages that have reviewed the MDG progress and shortfalls, there's almost always a section which concludes that poor data and monitoring mechanisms, inadequate governance, and information and capacity constraints have impeded proper planning, policy actions, service delivery, and ultimately retarded achievement of the goals. And yet the call for inclusion of access to information as a core MDG component remains unfulfilled. We know that without greater access to information, governments cannot be held accountable for use of the funds meant to meet the MDGs, that there is a lack of effective coordination within the public administrations and with its development partners, that there's an inefficient allocation of resources and an inability to accurately measure progress and gather important lessons for successes and to avoid failures. And yet again, the demand for explicit insertion of transparency mechanisms, including the right of access to information, in summit declaration and outcome documents remains largely unheard. In the action agenda for 2010 to 2015, transparency and the right of access to information are not listed, but rather mentioned in a companion report as a mere acceleration strategy. We must encourage MDG countries, both donor and recipient countries, to unambiguously and unequivocally recognize the need for transparency and access to information to achieve these goals. There should be transparency and access to information at the formation of policy, the implementation of services, and monitoring of progress. As the great orator, well, pop star, Bono, put it in his recent op-ed on the MDGs, quote, speaking of transparency, let's have a little more, please. When it comes to the question of who is doing what, toward which goal, and to what effect, we have to know where we are to know how far we've left to go. There's still time, but without the commitment to the right of access to information and other transparency measures, the fight against poverty and improvement of lives will not be met in the next 5 years. Agenda item 2, We must assure the commitment of all donor and recipient countries to greater transparency and access to information on development aid. Billions of dollars of aid flows annually from donor countries to the developing world. This aid is made up of taxpayer money and is meant to achieve great things, including building of necessary infrastructure, capacity creation for public administrations, access to justice and rule of law, health and education, and the assurance of better lives for those at the greatest risk. But as with the MDGs, until recently, transparency in the development aid flow has not been an imperative. Governments who are not transparent in their aid commitments and allocations can hamper a country's ability to plan and implement programs, while on the other side, opaque recipient countries assure that citizens remain voiceless in determining priorities and holding their government to account for use of those resources. The call for greater transparency in resource flows has been growing louder, but we must amplify this demand with action. Development partners should publish how they are allocating aid to countries and under what conditions, and aid recipients should be charged with fully and timely disclosure of how they are allocating and spending these monies. As a recent report on aid transparency noted, there are sometimes trade-offs and contradictions between transparency and accountability at home and transparency and accountability in recipient countries. Moreover, there is the inherent risk that with too much transparency, there will be a backlash against development aid when its failings and imperfections are laid bare. But we must not abide by the adage that what we do in Vegas stays in Vegas. We have to be as transparent in countries in which we work as in the countries in which we live. And when it comes to development aid, we should be robust enough in our conviction toward our efforts to welcome the oversight and accountability that transparency and access to information will afford. The new International Aid Transparency Initiative is a multi-stakeholder initiative designed to promote transparency and accountability to taxpayers in donor countries and to aid beneficiaries in recipient countries. While many big bilateral development aid agencies, such as DFID, the British Development Aid Agency, have agreed to the EADI principles, there remain countless others that have not. We must continue to encourage all donor agencies, public and private, to advance transparency in their funding and demand it from their recipients. And going back to one of my new favorite statesmen, again, Bono, he wrote, quote, "The promise we made at the start of this century was not to perpetuate the old relationships between donors and recipients, but to create new ones, with true partners accountable to each other and above all to the citizens these systems are supposed to work for." Agenda item 3, greater attention and focus on advancing the right of access to information must be placed in Africa. Presently, only 5 countries in Africa have a statutory right of access to information. This accounts for 7.5% of the region and includes includes Zimbabwe, which, as many of you know, is actually considered a repressive law rather than a right of access to information. While a number of African nations have a constitutional right to information, there's no proper implementing legislation to facilitate its use. The one true success story, South Africa, is now at danger at having its relatively robust access to information regime undermined by a new Secrecy Act. Africa lags far behind the rest of the world in its passage and implementation of access to information legislation, and yet arguably perhaps it has the greatest need of any continent. In a continent where much underdevelopment and poverty is directly linked to corruption, the call for access to information has never been more urgent. As with many regions, Africa does not lack for declarations and treaties affirming the right of access to information. The African Charter on Human and People's Rights has an article calling for the right of access to information, and the 32nd Ordinary Session of the African Union in 2002 adopted the Declaration of Principles on Freedom of Expression that includes the right to information. In fact, at the most recent session of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights in May 2010, they adopted a resolution, only one of 4 resolutions adopted, on the deteriorating situation of freedom of expression and access to information in Africa. In February 2010, the Carter Center held the African Regional Conference on the Right of Access to Information, a follow-on from the international conference held in Atlanta in 2008. At that conference, a number of transparency challenges in Africa were identified, including lack of political will, fear that information will be used as a political weapon, weak administrative capacity, cultural inhibitors, and absence of adequate economic and social infrastructure, but also a number of opportunities for advancement. The conference concluded with 16 specific country action plans and the more comprehensive African regional findings and plan of action. As with the MDGs and development aid discussed above, there has never been a more important moment to focus on greater transparency and access to information in Africa than right now. It would not only serve as a multiplier effect on other governance initiatives, but also provide voice to the most vulnerable. This leads me to my fourth agenda item for this decade: guarantee that women have equal access to information. Everyone has a need to information, but no one group more so than women. Access to information and voice ought to be a guarantee to all, including vulnerable populations, marginalized persons, and the powerless. But even among the poor, women remain marginalized and overlooked. Access to information is not gender neutral. But imagine for a moment the transformative effect greater information would have if women received information and were able to apply it for their families and their communities. A recent report found that for every year a woman is educated, infant mortality decreases by 10%. Access to information can provide decision and action levers so that women can more effectively participate in priority setting and assure that her family receives all necessary public services. Unfortunately, many women groups themselves are not actively involved in promoting freedom of information or prioritizing it. They often concentrate on other themes, such as health, education, and domestic violence, even while recognizing the positive change an increase in information would bring to those core issues. One poignant reminder of the lack of female engagement and leadership came during the organization of our African conference. For every woman we invited and who declined, she sought to substitute herself with a man. As President Carter said in his speech at the opening of the conference, as one of the elders, a group assembled by Nelson Mandela, we are committed to the realization of equality and empowerment of all women and girls. Access to information will play a large role in assuring this equality, but we must foment female leaders to drive this issue. The deterrents to gender equality and access to information are great. Not only are women organizations failing to prioritize this issue, but cultural mora continue to serve as a barrier. I know many of you have heard this story before, but perhaps it bears repeating. The Carter Center has been working, or had been working, in Mali, West Africa, for a period of time, and I was lucky enough to be there meeting with a number of the leaders in the communities. And I had a really interesting meeting with actually the head of the media organization, so the head of all of the media owners and workers. And he was very enthusiastic about having a right of access to information in Mali. And as we were going on in our discussion, he paused at one moment and looked at me and said, "You know, we're only talking about access to information for men, right?" And I said, "Excuse me, this would be for everyone." And he said, "Oh, no, no, we can't have information for women. That would scare them. It's our role as a man to protect them." And we both took a deep breath and realized that perhaps we were coming at this from different places. In the next decade, we all need to be on the same page. Women must have equal access to information.
Laura, I'm curious, and this will show my ignorance of Mali, is that a Muslim country?
It is, yes.
Okay, I wasn't sure. I guess it's less.
I don't think that was part of the issue, though. I think it was much more their culture of protectiveness of women and children and their sense that information can be quite scary if it's something that's not positive, and that women should be protected from bad information.
I didn't mean to imply that if it were a Muslim country, and I truly didn't know one way or the other, that made it necessarily more understandable or acceptable from your perspective. But you say you think it's even beyond a religious matter.
Absolutely. Okay, it's a gendered issue. I mean, if we look at issues around information communication technologies, it's women who are behind on every bit of accessing information technologies. If we even think about, and many of you are with us in Africa, and it's great, thank you, to see so many colleagues here. We had a really interesting conversation about culture, and there were many at the African conference who refused to see this as a cultural issue, sensing that if we said it was culturally based, that that would in some way pit Africa versus other continents and put in play questions that they felt the issues of accountability and corruption are not cultural and that they're learned. Yet, on the other hand, we had a gentleman who is South African, actually a South African parliamentarian, who talked of his time as a youth and having to go into the circumcision tent and at 13 and being told, you can't tell anybody what happened here. You have to keep everything secret. What happens in our cultural traditions has to remain secret. If you're to tell anybody, you know, all these horrible things will happen to you. Now, 50 years later, he's the head of one of the commissions that's being told, you must be transparent, you must be open, you must give information. And for him, it's a constant struggle. So I don't think it's religious. I think there is a cultural aspect. I think it's, though, a very gendered cultural aspect still, and not just in Africa.
That's a very valuable amplification, I think, yes.
In the coming years, we should strive to encourage more engagement by the women's movement and to explicitly include the right to information language in conventions and treaties that call for the elimination of discrimination against women and for equal rights. I think I'm just going to have one other point. Actually, I've got a colleague here from Jamaica, and when she and I were working on access to information in Jamaica, it was a huge struggle to get the women's groups engaged, and she was brilliant. And instead of framing this as a women's issue, she framed it as a children's issue. And all of a sudden, all these groups were interested because then they could see it as something to help the kids in the orphanages. But I think we were beating our heads against a wall as we tried to frame this more broadly as, well, this is an issue for everybody. I think we needed to really tie it to something outside of themselves.
That's pure political acumen, is it not, knowing how to best frame an issue?
My fifth agenda item is to promote increased access to information of multilateral organizations and that they play a greater leadership role. I'm not going to talk too much about this one because I know we're going to have a lot of time on this afternoon, but I want to focus on the role not just of themselves being more transparent, and it's something that we've talked a lot about with the World Bank and the development banks, and I've got a great colleague here from the Organization of American States and the role that the OAS has to play, but it's really a leadership role. A World Bank poll recently showed that a plurality of citizens would rather that the World Bank not give any funding in their country until they take measures to fight corruption. And a slightly lower percentage would prefer that the World Bank only give funding to NGOs and none of the money to go to government at all, mainly because of this question of corruption and lack of information. We have to find a way to engage the multilateral organizations and to engage them more positively. And as we started to think about this in the various conferences that we held, I think one of the themes that came out is that we need to go beyond just the World Bank, beyond just the OAS or the AU, and really get to the sub-regional organizations, that it's working with groups like ECOWAS and SADC and CARICOM that we can have the greater impact. And so although I haven't developed this agenda item as much as the other four, because I think it's something that we need to really consider, we need to learn what the successes are with the multilateral organizations. We need to see if the World Bank, as it starts to roll out and implement their new disclosure policy, and as the OAS starts to implement or encourage implementation of their new model law on access to information for the region, if these are functioning. And if they're not functioning, then we need to think again. Because as you know much better than I, the World Bank provides more money to governments than often their own tax revenue per stream provides. So the relationships between some of the multilateral organizations, whether it's the IADB or the AFDB or the World Bank or the regional organizations like the OAS and the AU, et cetera, the power that they hold both to encourage greater transparency internally but also with their partners is something that I think we need to continue to develop. So just to remind you, because, again, Dan took away my conclusion in the words of President Obama, the five to me in
But I read only a few of them. There were many others.
No, I had the same ones.
Pardon me?
I had the same ones.
Would you like to include this one right here?
I'd actually like to get my thing from Bono. I've been really happy including Bono.
Obama, Bono, I take your point. It's close call.
Yes. Or, you know, we can just go to John Lennon, give peace a chance. But really, I do think that over the next decade, we need to continue to expand our transparency agenda. It needs to go beyond just counting laws. And I, with all due respect to my colleagues who are coming this afternoon, I think there's a lot to be said for how many countries have laws. There's much less understood about how those laws are being implemented. Are they being enforced? And what impact are they having on the communities in which are so in need? So again, the five, to me, imperatives in the areas that I would like to develop with all of you are the explicit inclusion of transparency and access to information in the MDGs, more transparency in development aid, more access to information for women, greater focus and attention on Africa, and starting to develop strategies for engaging multilateral institutions, but at the sub-regional level. And when we gather back here next year, we should bring specific commitment to promote transparency, to fight corruption, and to energize civic engagement and to leverage new technologies so, as President Obama said, we strengthen the foundation of freedom in our own countries while living up to the ideals that can light the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I know we want to have a good, robust session of question and answer to deepen the dialogue on this, and I probably will exercise the prerogative of moderator to ask the first question. But before I do that, I want to make good on the promise that I just made to note that elsewhere in President Obama's speech to the UN last Thursday, there's a little phrase, but you know, just a little phrase or clause in a presidential statement can carry much significance, especially when it's in an international forum. And it echoes, I think, something that Laura said in her entire category, number four, with respect to women. And that little phrase is that he slipped in there, or his speechwriter did, but he certainly spoke this, in talking about the power of people and development and the like, and he said, including the potential of women and girls. And I think he included that phrase very much along the lines of, and for the same reason, you made that as a distinct category of the five items you spoke of. And I think it also has some connection to Africa and to the experience that you had in Mali. So I think it's a very encouraging thing that is right there at the tip of the presidential agenda, so to speak. Let me ask a first question, and people can line up at the microphones as well for further questions and dialogue. But I was very much struck by what I think is your nice metaphor of saying that now international transparency is in its teenage years. I'm always want to say that the Freedom of Information Act of this country began in 66, 200 years after Sweden in 1766, and there were three nations of the world, Sweden and Finland, which broke off, and the United States that really had transparency regimes in 66. And then 15 years later, when I became head of the government-wide transparency office in the Department of Justice in 1981, there were still only three nations of the world that had a transparency regime. Nothing had changed in those early years. Now you might want to call that maybe even certainly prepubescent, perhaps even prenatal almost at that stage. And then things started developing with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the later spurring on of fighting corruption, to be sure. But your metaphor was that we're now in sort of the FOIA's, international transparency's teenage years. And I wonder, is it possible, does it abuse your metaphor, or do you think that it fits in to say that just as parents worry about teenagers being prone to injury and not having a sense of their own mortality and perhaps suffering harm of that type, that now we have to worry about harm to what's already been done, or in a phrase differently, I'd say sort of retrenchment or backsliding. And I think that's certainly a concern with respect to South Africa. And it makes me think that all along we've been talking about the importance of enacting a statute, and then we've been very careful to say, okay, enacting is great, but there also has to be implementation. We've made that distinction. But now do we also have to say that we're in our teenage years, so to speak, that it's not just enactment and implementation, it's guarding against retrenchment, guarding against backsliding? Do you see that, what's happening in South Africa, as something that is a warning for people to watch out for? And I'm going to say there's a little bit of that in the UK, only on a small level, but there has been a little bit of backsliding there. Do you see that as a matter of growing concern?
Thank you. Certainly backsliding is a huge issue, and it's not just South Africa. Colleagues here from Mexico. Mexico has been another example of a country that we put up as being one of the model countries that is also backsliding because of political constraints. You know, it's an interesting question, this of backsliding. And partially, and going back to my metaphor, which we probably will all abuse today, to the point that we may not ever use it again.
No, I think we'll remember it quite well in the way that you articulated it.
I wonder, and I could have made this one of the agenda items, I wonder if as teenagers we're frustrated because somebody oversold us what it meant to be an adult. Do you remember when you guys became a teenager and you thought, oh, is this it? You know, you were so excited to get some of the freedoms and then realized with it came so many more responsibilities that as infants and young children we didn't have. And in some ways I wonder if as a movement we oversold a little bit, and that's where some of the backsliding's coming. Because it seems to me that governments wouldn't be able to do some of the entrenchments that they're doing, to put in some of the changes to existing statutes, to fail to implement if we had a more robust civil society, more robust oversight mechanisms, not within government, not independent oversight, but really civil society oversight. And I think this goes to one of the things that we've recognized, which this still unfortunately has remained very much a right of the elite, that we haven't, except for in very, very particular circumstances, seen people who are most in need of this really taking hold of it. And I don't think that's necessarily unique. I think it has taken decades for people, for example, in the United States, to really understand that we have a right to information and that we have a right to request it and demand it and expect it. But part of the entrenchment, I think, is one, of course, I think governments have recognized what they did to themselves, and that's certainly the case. If you hear, what did Tony Blair say? The stupidest thing or the most idiotic thing he did while in office wasn't start the war in Iraq, but actually allow the passage of their Freedom of Information Act.
The actual quote is devastating. We'll read it out later this morning when we talk to our folks in the UK, but it's just an astonishingly trenchant quote from Tony Blair.
I mean, I do think governments don't, I mean, luckily, thankfully, they don't totally realize what they're getting themselves into, or nobody would actually pass an access to information law. So I think on the one hand, when the reality hits for governments, they want to pull back. They don't want to be spending their time, their resources, and their political goodwill on things like access to information. On the other hand, they're able to do that because I think in many ways we haven't yet gotten to that tipping point where people in the communities in which we're working are angry enough or pained enough to stand up and demand their right to information and demand that governments not take that away.
Well, you mentioned Mexico, and I neglected to mention that in the same breath as South Africa. Could you elaborate a little bit more on what is seen as current or even prospective backsliding in Mexico?
I think, as with many new regimes, there was a lot of euphoria when the Mexican law was passed and was implemented, and President Fox, the then president, put in place an independent oversight mechanism, the International EFI, the Federal Institute for Access to Information, with its Spanish acronym. And it was seen as a very independent, very strong oversight mechanism to ensure both the implementation but also the enforcement. As they had a successive president who was maybe less committed to full transparency, different members of EFI were replaced. And in some ways it became very politicized. And so I think some of people's trust in that institution and the importance of that institution has eroded. At the same time, there was some passage of a constitutional right that was encouraging states to put laws into place, but also has not been fully enforced, fully implemented in the states. And so for every step forward, there's been perhaps a step or two back. And again, Mexico is another great example. There's an organization, an initiative called Comunidades, communities, trying to get people in the communities more invested, more interested. But it is a struggle to get people to engage this issue and see this as important and transformative for their lives.
Thank you. It looks like we have a question from this side of the room over here. And I hope that microphone is working. It sometimes requires a button to be pushed.
Hello?
Yes.
There you go.
Thank you very much. That was
hopefully your question will push a button with Ms. Newman. Well.
I'll try. Thanks very much. That was a very interesting presentation, and I like how you laid out agenda items. My name is Carol Excel. I'm a senior associate at the World Resources Institute. I'm interested in two areas of what you discussed. One is about the MDGs. You spoke about the fact that the documents and the outcome documents really don't speak to transparency and accountability and how to improve the current situation with governments reporting on their MDGs. Where do you think the buttons are? Who needs to be influenced to change this dialogue? Is it the UN itself? Is it working in regions? Is it specific national governments? How do you think we can influence a change as 5 years to achieve these, some of them quite ambitious targets? And I know there's already been dialogue about how some of them we cannot meet, but how can we make sure government is more accountable and transparent, governments are more accountable and transparent, to really put all efforts forward to meeting these MDGs? And as I said, who are the influence targets? That's the first question. The second question relates to Africa. You spoke about the need to really focus on Africa. I wonder with what you spoke about you know, some of the issues that you have in Africa, and the focus has to be on, you know, basic needs in a number of countries. How do you persuade governments to put aside the necessary resources to deal with some of these transparency and accountability issues? Is there an expectation that the money to implement these regimes comes from donors or the World Bank or other institutions, or is it expected that these countries with very restrictive funding and budgets will have to fund this kind of new regime? Thanks.
Thank you for such sophisticated questions. It reminds me that beforehand, Laura told me that she speaks at many conferences like this, and she's sometimes disappointed when the questions are not challenging. And I assured her that at this law school, we have a tradition of asking sophisticated and challenging questions. And whereupon she started to withdraw what she said. No. Can I ask you, Laura, just before you answer that first question, the acronym that was used, just for our webcast audience to pronounce out that acronym, just to cover the possibility that someone viewing on the webcast might not follow exactly what that acronym is.
MDG?
Yes, please.
The Millennium Development Goals.
Okay. Millennium Development Goals.
Maybe we should take a few questions.
My name is Marcos Mendiburu from the World Bank Institute. And I have questions and kind of comments for you, actually similar to the one that Carol said on Africa. I would like maybe you can elaborate what you see the challenges in Africa are. Some of the tension in Accra in the conference that the Carter Center and other different organizations are in favor, but one of the issues was that some governments see these as media bills that media associations are pushing about. And you basically said this is seen in some countries as an elitist life, not the grassroots groups are engaged. So I would like to see, hear your opinion on that. As well as whether you see that these sectoral transparency initiatives, EITI, COAST, META, are undermining efforts of pushing for access to information, or they complement each other. And the second point is about resources, and I think Carol mentioned it. I mean, at the World Bank specifically, and access to information, most of the world is funded through grants. Governments don't want to borrow money from the World Bank on transparency. So how can we start a discussion? I mean, my question to you is, have you ever engaged with a minister of finance tell him or her that transparency agenda needs resources, it's worth investing. So I think this is a big challenge that we will have. I mean, we're having this discussion internally at the World Bank. We want to support this agenda, but nobody wants to get money for us on this. They want to build, you know, infrastructure, support schools, health centers, etc. So I wonder how we can engage ministers of finance early in this discussion when the laws are being formulated to let them know that this needs to be supported with resources.
Do you want to comply
with
the question?
I want an
easy one. we can't wait until an easy one comes. You have to start answering even the hard ones.
All right, we'll take one more. Could you give me a softball, please?
I'm Dan Scholar with the National Academy of Public Administration. So I'm, of course, interested in public administration and public administration of the U.S. government. You did indicate your key area of more transparency and development aid, which is very obvious and very important. I'd like to step back. What about more transparency in government contractor obligations? So much of American governmental delivery of services is now contracted out, or maybe policy heavy, maybe not policy heavy, but third party contractors are required to do the work of government, perhaps in a majority sense today. I believe the figures actually read that. My question is, what can be done, what should be done here? And I see an opportunity because we have an administration that is transparency compliant, that is interested in transparency. Are we doing enough when we contract out this massive government services to require that government contractors pay attention to their transparency obligations, pay a lot of attention, and knowing also that often these services have some global connotation. They can't avoid having that if they're big contracts. And are we doing enough in that area to see that they too are adding to more to transparency in government aid, and transparency in government services, interaction in all ways?
Thank you.
Well, our speaker now has a backlog, not unlike a FOIA backlog of questions, totaling five, the same number of subject areas you had in your keynote speech.
Okay,
are you ready to tackle them?
I am. Well, I'm ready to start. And again, let me just remind you all that I put those agenda items out there for us as a community to develop. So I would hate for anyone to walk away thinking that I have the answers. I have some thoughts on these matters, but certainly I look to you as equal experts and colleagues in this to join in what I've put out as a five agenda items and to add your own. I'm actually going to start with the last one first, mainly because I actually have an answer for that one, where the others I'm less certain. I'm on less stable ground. So the transparency in government contracting out services, absolutely. It is a huge problem in the United States. Thankfully, most of our colleagues around the world saw the problems with the United States Freedom of Information Act and actually included provisions in their laws that allowed for information from the private sector when it's on public services. So the kinds of exemptions that we see here, the kinds of secrecy, big pockets of blackness that we find in the United States would not be acceptable in most of those other 90 countries that Dan mentioned. And so certainly what I would encourage in the United States, frankly, at this point, is an overhaul of the Freedom of Information Act. I think we've been dancing around the issue for the last 10 years, and it's time for us to go straight at it and say, our freedom of information law is failing. It's failing us. It's no longer a modern piece of legislation. We do in the United States have great transparency, but it's not because of the Freedom of Information Act. It's much more because we have a culture of transparency, that we've understood the role of government as a service delivery agent and one that needs to provide us information. But I think it's time, with all of the problems that we're still seeing with implementation, all the problems that we're still seeing with these areas of great secrecy, for us to review, well, and of oversight and enforcement, it's time for us to perhaps that should be added to our agenda for the next decade, to really join voices and call for a new Freedom of Information Act that takes into account the present circumstances under which we live, that learns from people, whether it's South Africa and Mexico or some of these other countries, that are actually, even with their backsliding, in some ways doing better than we are.
Do you mean that it's possible that the Freedom of Information Act could be amended in this country more than every 10 years? Or at less intervals, at a shorter interval than every 10 years?
My problem with the amendments is that they're Band-Aids. And these Band-Aids are fraying. They're not, I mean, I love my metaphors. They're not using duct tape. They're using, you know, little Band-Aids for big tears. And so I think that there's a moment, and maybe President Obama has provided us this moment, to really take a hard look at what is working with our Freedom of Information Act and where is it no longer a modern piece of legislation. And rather than continuously do little repair jobs on it, perhaps do a wholesale change.
Okay. Well, I can pick up whether you want to take the metaphor of dancing or the Band-Aid and just elaborate on that and tell you that in the 2007 FOIA amendments, there was indeed a provision included that spoke to contractors and contractor records, quote unquote, but it used somewhat ambiguous language and has been narrowly construed by first the Bush administration, so it's not even clear how much of a Band-Aid it was. So there was something on contractor records, but I think your metaphor of dancing around is a very apt one there. I can tell you from where I sit or where I used to sit, yes, that legislation that was passed in 2007 is of such character that it could be interpreted broadly, implemented more broadly by the administration that wanted to do so. Certainly that does not describe the Bush administration. It made it clear that it did not want to interpret it at its broadest scope. And frankly, my best guess is that the Obama administration has not focused on that yet.
I actually think this is a great segue into the kind of questions that Carol and Marcus were asking. And go back a little bit to what I was saying earlier. When we talk about how are we going to change this paradigm, how are we going to shift to a culture of greater openness, how are we going to encourage governments to be more transparent and to spend their resources on this, I think we just need to look at how we're working with governments. Right now, governments are very comfortable in the status quo. Obama administration is probably pretty comfortable in the status quo that the Bush administration had started in keeping most contracts secret. What we as a community need to do is make that status quo so uncomfortable that change is more beneficial, that being more open actually outweighs the risks that openness provide. And I don't think we've yet hit on that formula of how do we make it so uncomfortable for governments to remain in the status quo that they're willing to take some of the challenges on to be more transparent. I'll go through your questions, but I think that in many ways that really underpins so much of what in this next decade we have to figure out. Part of it is being able to identify where there's been impacts, what are the positive lessons, and I know and I really am so thankful to people like the World Bank, who, especially the World Bank Institute, who continue to try and do and support some of that research that we need in order to be more effective. But I think we as a community need to figure out who are our champions, how do we raise them up, and how do we address those who continue to be the obstacles. And the question of MDGs, how do we change the dialogue? Unfortunately, I think we missed a big opportunity in New York. I think we as civil society certainly have not been nearly as engaged as we should have been throughout this process of getting these issues of transparency and access to information into the documents, not just into the rhetoric, not just into the accompanying documents, but into the core documents. But I do think that as governments are starting to give their country reports and there's greater recognition of the potential for failure for most countries to meet the MDGs, the opening will become wider, and that we need to be prepared to step through that opening or step through that door and try to make the argument that unless they start to engage transparency and accountability in a much more serious way, that the world writ large, but particularly the UN and the World Bank and others who have funded the MDGs, it will be seen as a failure for all the progress that we've made. I think President Obama gave us a good starting point. I may be slightly more skeptical as to how far we're going to be able to take that. I think, he's in many ways confronted with the dilemma that transparency provides, that on the one hand it's definitely good, but that there's a lot of uncomfortable moments with transparency. We need to find, who do we influence? I think that's a great question. I think in the zero-sum document, as we all know, didn't nearly enough identify the failures of lack of transparency. I think the Six Question campaign that you're a part of, where people in civil society are asking questions of their government around MDGs and are showing how little information the governments themselves have on the progress that they've made, is a good tool. It's a good tool for awareness raising and embarrassment. We need to then think, how do we make that a positive tool for change? And that's why putting it on the agenda now, we have 5 years, and that's not very long. But it's certainly time to still influence. On Africa, how to persuade governments to deal with transparency and accountability, and where does the money come from? There's questions on the challenges and resources. The challenges are huge. I mean, we've talked about the challenges. There's very little political will. There's lots of countries in transformation coming out of conflict. There is a huge lack of capacity. I'm really privileged to be working in Liberia and have learned quite a bit working in a post-conflict country, even just in the last year that we've been working there. I don't think we understand, many of us, the flight of capacity that happens when a country goes into war, and trying to bring people back with that capacity and then ensure that they're brought back in a way that doesn't create problems with people who remain during the war is a huge challenge. Building the resources, the infrastructure. And some of you have heard this. I talked to one of the archivists who was in charge of all the land titles. And when the war happened, he fled the country. He fled from Liberia. And he was so excited because of the 15 tomes of land titles, he was able to save 7. Well, that means that there's all of these land title documents that are lost. And what's the greatest reason for conflict in our world today but land? So I think the challenges are enormous, especially in these post-conflict countries, countries that don't see this as a priority, that have never had to make it a priority. Countries who get development aid regardless of their governance, what is the reason to then place more impact or more emphasis, on governance? Another little story from Liberia which really surprised me was talking to people around the Truth and Reconciliation Commission who were talking about needing to keep the documents that they had received and some of the information secret. And we were talking about the value of making it open so that people could heal and could move on from, the decades-long conflict. But their fear was that so many leaders, so many people who are still part of public life are named in those documents, that it would be incredibly destabilizing to this very fragile democracy to actually be transparent and to have more access to information. So the challenges in some of these countries are enormous. But I go back to Liberia, there are incredible champions from Madam Sirleaf on down, who have really recognized that without moving towards greater transparency, all of these little efforts that they're making are going to be unsustainable unless they start to change their relationship with their citizens. And this is really the plug, I think, that works in post-conflict countries. And you talked about the politics of this, and it is real politique trying to find what is the handle that you can use? And in every country, it's going to be different. But certainly in Liberia, it's really been about how do you identify the causes, the root causes of conflict, and overcome them. And for Mali, it's been very much issues of corruption and lack of trust. And so for them, moving towards greater transparency seems to be somewhat of a no-brainer, even given all of the challenges that they face in doing that. In other countries, there's going to be other reasons for greater transparency. We know in South Africa it was coming out of apartheid. We know we need to take advantage of key moments. I mean, Marcos raised this for Africa, but Argentina, where he's from, is a perfect example. They've been working for over a decade trying to have the right of access to information, and they were very close to it at a moment in which the country was in transition. Unfortunately, that didn't get moved beyond passage of the law in the Senate. But I do think in Africa, particularly identifying some of these key moments, Guinea is going through its first election Ivory Coast in 50 years. How can we take advantage of a potentially more democratic country to really engage their leaders on transparency? And that's got to be something that comes not just from people like the Carter Center or, you know, NGOs, but also from people like y'all at the World Bank who continue to say, this is what's going to make your regime sustainable. This is how you're going to move beyond the place that you are. Where does the money come from? I mean, look at the MDGs. I think that's such a perfect example. The reports coming out now say that it's not for lack of money. Yes, there's problems with the flow of development aid, that there's been lots of promises made that haven't come through, that it's not coming through timely, that it's not exactly as the countries had anticipated. But it's not for a lack of money that these countries aren't meeting their MDG goals. There's sufficient resources being thrown at these problems. It's just the way it's being applied. And so much of that is because of a lack of transparency and accountability. So I find it to be a red herring when a government says, we have no money to be more transparent. Because frankly, it costs money to be secretive too. And so I'm not suggesting that, you know, countries who are just coming out of conflict like Liberia, that every single institution, that they should have a Cadillac law like Mexico's, or that every single institution should be up to par in 6 months' time. I don't even think every country needs a law. I think that there's lots of things that can be done to be more transparent without having a statutory right to transparency. I think ultimately they will need a law, but I think there's lots of mechanisms that can be begun in any country. And certainly we've seen example after example of how that helps save money in the long term when there's greater transparency. Questions on sectoral transparency. Well, okay, questions on it being seen as a media law. I mean, I think it's a really interesting dynamic. It didn't happen in the Americas. I mean, the media was engaged in some of our countries. In many of our countries in Latin America, they were actually the obstacle, as some of us know, to getting laws passed. Because they didn't want it. Whereas in Africa, it's really the media that's been pushing it because civil society is relatively weak, that the media has taken the forefront. But that's, as we know, been somewhat detrimental because what government in their right mind wants to give a hammer to somebody who's going to use it to beat them over the head? Yeah. And so I think...
Are you paraphrasing Tony Blair right there?
Exactly.
That's pretty much exactly what he said.
But I think that's why we need to, again, deal with this question of elitism. Who really is using these laws? How can we get more groups to take ownership of it? How can we show this as not just a media law, but a citizen right law? The question on sectoral transparency is really interesting, and talk about people knowing me here and pushing my hot buttons. I think there's a lot of great effect one can have with sectoral transparency. And what that means is a focus on one specific sector, whether that's just the environment or natural resources. Marcos mentioned the construction industry or medicine transparency. I do think that it's a great way to demonstrate the importance and the value of access to information, because you can get deep much faster. You can focus, you know, one agency or one ministry, one area, you have more natural allies. Carol Excel is from the World Resource Institute. She knows who's going to be interested in environmental issues. She's got an already created group of people who have said, I'm interested. So if she works on the environment, it's easier to identify her stakeholders than for people who want to work more generally on the right of access to information. So I absolutely see some benefits. I also think that in some ways it becomes the focus and doesn't actually lead to greater transparency for a number of reasons. One, it's not how government works. Anybody who's been part of government knows that you're not siloed that way. You know, working, for example, on extractive industries, you can't just work with the Ministry of Mining. You have to work with the Ministry of Mining, the Ministry of Infrastructure, the Ministry of Finance. You have to work with, if you have to, you have to work with the Ministry of Environment. So it's not that you can actually take that small little piece the way that some of our sectoral or colleagues like to do. I think the second big problem with it is that it hasn't actually shown to have this trickle effect to greater transparency across government. There may be moments of transparency within those sectors, but we don't know yet if they're sustainable because these sectoral initiatives are relatively new. And they certainly haven't encouraged greater transparency in other sectors. We haven't said, oh, look, you know, environment is so much more transparent, now everybody else be more transparent. And so in that way, there needs to be a way to marry the two. Marcos, you know the story. We went to Peru, which has an access to information law. They also have a lot of focus on extractive industries, and they have an extractive industries transparency initiative. We met with the EITI secretariat, and they said, oh, we're having so much difficulty, and it's multi-sector stakeholders, so it's government, civil society, and the private sector. They're sitting at the table, and the Minister of Mines, or Deputy Minister, is there, being very, very quiet, and one of the people spoke up and said, oh, we're having so much difficulty getting information that we need from not just the Ministry of Mines, but some of these other ministries. And I said, well, have you made any access to information requests? And they looked at me with blank stares. And I said, but y'all have an access to information law. You have a statutory right to information. If you're not getting the information, you can make it, you can go to court. It's enforceable where these sectoral initiatives are not. But there just had been no relationship built between those two stakeholder groups. So I think that there's absolutely a place for sectoral initiatives, and maybe Africa's the place for it, because it allows for some incremental changes. But it needs to be married with these campaigns for broad-based, statutory, enforceable rights of information. Marcos, you also asked, so are they undermining the efforts? No. Are they distracting? In some countries, yes. Frankly, they are distracting because governments are able to say, well, we've got EITI, why do we need anything else? Or look, we've got this transparency regulation on environment, why do we need anything else? But generally, I think they can be very positive. They just need to be married better with other ongoing initiatives. Governments don't want to borrow money. Well, yeah, they don't want to borrow money. I think certainly it's going to be you as the World Bank and us as a community of practice to help them to see that borrowing money for things like good governance and transparency will not cause harm. You asked if I'd ever talked to a minister about this. In fact, I think you probably know I have. And I will give the example of the minister of the Ministry of the Presidency in Nicaragua, where they very much wanted to be more transparent, and found after a period of time that they weren't able to get grants to do it, that they were going to have to take loans. And it was actually not only their citizens who were pushing back and saying, well, don't take loans in our name for this, but the donors themselves and the World Bank and others in the way that they wanted to provide the loans, where they would cherry pick what they wanted to allow loans for, which oftentimes didn't include salaries or the infrastructure, the human infrastructure necessary in order to advance. So donor agencies are happy. I mean, sorry, I hope I'm going to speak out of turn. Japan loves to give money to build things. But where is the money to build capacities? You know, and so I think that there's a problem all around. So it's not just trying to convince governments to take loans in order to implement access to, or to establish access to information regimes, which is an uphill battle, as you point out, in and of itself, because very few governments are going to take a loan for something that's not very tangible. But it's also the way in that the donor agencies are creating these loans and the payback times and how they're being laid out in the country. I think some of it's a PR problem as much as anything else. Because certainly if we had the proof that I know you're trying to get, but if we had the proof to say for every dollar that you make more transparent, you save 90%. or you're able to, you know, take the money that you're putting into the public health sector and amplify its impact because of greater transparency. I mean, if we had those figures, if we found a way to get that, then it would be much more difficult for governments to say we don't want to take a loan or we don't want to take money in order to create greater transparency. But right now we just don't have that. We don't have it in a way that is persuasive enough. So it's much harder, I think, even for governments who want to take the money, like Nicaragua, to do it, knowing what a big PR problem they're going to have at the end of the day if they can't prove its impact.
Laura, you've done a terrific job of clearing out that backlog, so to speak. We could use you at some federal agencies to help clear out FOIA backlogs, but we do have time for one more question, I believe, and I see a gentleman right here.
Thanks. Gavin Baker, OMB Watch. So I have, in this order, a shameless promotion, a comment, and a question. The shameless promotion is about Laura's first and second points about aid transparency and MDGs in particular. OMB Watch did a letter to President Obama focusing on aid transparency and MDGs specifically. And going to this question of how to influence them, the hypothesis was that international groups with an international focus, had been involved on that point, but that maybe not many groups with a domestic focus had been involved looking at aid transparency in the MDGs, and that bringing more pressure from domestic groups to bear might help move that along. That's very early days, so I don't know whether my hypothesis will bear out or not, but I would encourage anybody to go to our website and look at our letter. And also, later today, we'll be posting an update on what happened last week at the MDG Summit and at the UN. So my question, or my comment is about the cultural factors. And in another field, not looking in the area of open government, but looking at the area of copyright, James Boyle has proposed this frame of cultural agoraphobia, that people are afraid of openness, because when control is removed, you don't know what could happen. And I think that in some ways could be a relevant way of looking at this question in terms of government control of information as well, that it's not necessarily that there are factors particular. Surely there are factors particular to certain cultures or certain countries that influence here, but that in some sense it's a deeper human desire to have control, and that the removing of control makes people afraid of what's going to happen. So the question is about your fourth point and the influence of transparency on women. This is something that I've been wondering about. Even in the U.S., so much of the emphasis on transparency groups here is on getting information on the web. But, of course, the digital divide remains an issue. Even where people have access to the Internet, there's differential impact in terms of what connections they have, what devices they use to access the Internet. And I've been wondering if there are frameworks for looking at the differential impacts of government transparency across different demographic groups. And I'm sure, as you know, with from a human rights perspective, there's this emphasis on disaggregated data so that you can look at the impact of different policies across different groups. And I'm wondering if there are any frameworks for looking at transparency in that way.
Great, thank you. And OMB Watch is fantastic. And we love Gary Bass and Sean Moulton, and you guys have done great work.
And Gary Bass is also a member of the advisory board of the Collaboration on Government Secrecy, I should add.
So I think your point about domestic groups is a really, it's a very interesting one. I think one of the problems that will face is that there's an incredible lack of awareness of the MDGs in recipient countries. So one of the biggest problems with getting domestic groups engaged in this is that they don't even know what the MDGs are. They don't know. I mean, look at the United States, really. I mean, how many people in the U.S. really know about this worldwide effort to have poverty? So much less in the countries in which money is being applied. So I think oftentimes international NGOs or groups have stepped in largely because there's not either the capacity at the domestic level or not a great awareness. But I take your point, and certainly I think increasingly getting domestic actors involved. I do think countries are different. A lot of the countries, at least in which we work, are much more open to hearing things from an international NGO than they are from a domestic NGO. Mm-hmm. And there's much less risk in us saying something than there would be, you know, in a civil society organization from that country. That's obviously not the case in a lot of the developed nations, but certainly in the developing nations. And shame is really a fantastic way to get people to incentive. And I think that there's a lot more shame when an international NGO points their finger or international organizations point their finger for use of this example, smaller country in the Caribbean, than if, you know, someone within the Caribbean themselves is saying, or in their country is saying, look, you haven't done what you're supposed to. So I think it cuts both ways. But again, I think it's a really big umbrella. There's a huge tent here, and we all need to be inside it, and certainly working together and learning from your successes. As for a framework, I have to say, in many of these, other than, frankly, the first two, which was the MDGs, just as a reminder, the MDGs and development aid, there is very, very scant research available on the other three issues. And the multilaterals, I tried to find, and this is why I put it open to all of us together to develop, there's a lot on the development agencies, what the World Bank should be doing, what the, you know, Asian Development Bank, very little on what sub-regional organizations should be doing or are doing. Very little focus on that. And gender, there is one scholar that's written on the gendered issue of transparency and accountability. There's one report that came out of Africa that looked at Feminet, that looked at five different countries and the way that women's organizations have engaged in those five countries to promote transparency. Beyond that, it's pretty scant. And certainly, one of our researchers is here with us, who had done a lot of research on it, sitting behind you, kind of talking. And I know she can. One of our researchers can also tell you that, in fact, there's very little on gender and transparency. And so, certainly, it's an area that we need to put a lot more effort. There is a lot on gender and ICTs, but ICTs are not the same thing as access to information. And so, I think we need to really focus on how do you get information to people, not through information communication technologies, but really truly get information to people, to women, and then how can they use it to transform their lives. So that was a probably bad answer to a really good question.
You're going to have to repeat the question, I think, for our webcast audience.
The question is, have there been, if I understand it, has there been research on the impact of access to information in a disaggregated way on race, on socioeconomic levels? There's, not that I know of, there's a lot of anecdotes. There's anecdotal information available. I'm looking to my five colleagues who all work on this issue as well. Do you guys know of anything? Okay.
In the environmental sector, there has been. Looking at, of course, you know a lot of this work. OMB does a lot of this kind of work in the U.S. But in other countries, they're starting to look at the impact of environmental information to different types of sectors and different types of groups. Less in Africa, but more in other countries in Latin America and Asia.
Laura, I think you've more than lived up to your reputation as a font of knowledge of all things transparent and international, or international and transparent. Let me ask you just to close it off, and we'll let you go this morning, but you're coming back for the World Bank panel this afternoon. Speaking of Liberia, are you in a position to confirm or deny a rumor that has been circulating around the international transparency now for a number of days? I'm not suggesting that we all meet in a Starbucks in the Azores somewhere regularly, but on the internet, that the president of Liberia is intending to sign that legislation that is on her desk today on International Right to Know Day. And I realized that in Liberia, it's now
4 hours later.
It's now 4 hours later. Thank you. Can you confirm or deny that rumor that today will be the day that Liberia's law will be signed into effect by the president there?
No.
Okay.
No, honestly, I think that there's been a lot of talk about her doing it today. I know she wanted to do it when she came back from New York. She's really committed to it. I heard my phone. I heard a text message come through, so that's why. But I have no idea. I mean, we were really hoping. But I know she's going to do it soon. She's committed herself to doing it.
She might be on the phone right now.
Yeah. You know, yeah, she could be calling you now.
She wouldn't be calling me. I didn't mean to imply that. It would be you, without any doubt.
But I think, you know, it's been a really amazing time in Liberia. Civil society really came to the forefront. The Senate, the House Assembly was really engaged in this. And her administration has continuously said, we're just waiting. We're ready to go. We want to start. You know, we're already making efforts. So I think Liberia could be one of our great success stories in Africa. In the very, very near future.
Well, thank you. I fear that that phone call was our participant in Scotland saying she is ready to go, and we want to make that technical hookup right away. But please help me, everyone, in thanking Laura Newman for a very enlightening program. We will.